The shift from fresh to salt water would kill most animals. But loons, along with many ducks and other water birds, have evolved to be able to make that move. When a loon starts ingesting prey in water that's high in salt, that salt gets into its bloodstream. This sets off a complex physiological process that reaches its end point in a pair of glands above the eyes. These glands, also activated by the higher salt levels in the body, excrete the excess salt through a duct that leads to the bird's nostrils. From there, the salty solution runs down the beak and back into the environment. When switched on, the salt glands burn up a lot of calories. So it's possible that breeding adults nest on freshwater to save that energy for raising chicks. But most of these areas start to freeze over come late fall. And then it's time to seek a watery place that won't freeze. A salty one, like the Gulf of Mexico or Puget Sound. For BirdNote, I'm Michael Stein.
Hi there, this is Jan Arden, and if you're listening to something fabulous, well, you're listening to DJSF 90.1 FM Simon Fraser University Radio, streaming on the internet at cjsf.ca.
This is broadcasting from Burnaby Mountain.
Welcome to Scream Therapy. I'm your host, Jason Schurz. In October of 2018, I found myself in the hospital, sitting across from a psychiatrist who was telling me I had bipolar. I was sent home with a bunch of medication and laid on the couch for a week. I had my iTunes library on shuffle, trying to shake the hornet's nest from my head. Ever since I was a kid, I've been using loud music as a form of therapy. Punk rock and mental health have always been connected. This podcast looks at that connection through the lens of different guests. This is Scream Therapy. Navigating life on the spectrum has its fair share of obstacles and tribulations. Rob David of UK melodic hardcore band Death of Youth was diagnosed with autism at the age of 5. In his school years, he was bullied because of his differences and began to mask his autism. When he became part of the punk scene, Rob looked around and saw other people who were different. He realized he didn't need to hide anymore. Now a songwriter and performer, Rob is able to harness the creative aspects of living on the spectrum, and he has the tools to work through the difficult times. Being open about your challenges can inspire others. Just as Rob has looked up to other musicians on the spectrum, a new generation might see themselves in him.
My name is Rob David. I'm the vocalist for Death of Youth, a London-based melodic hardcore slash emo band, which started out as my bedroom project in 2018 and expanded into a full band in 2024. And I've been into punk rock since I was 14. I discovered Dookie by Green Day around late 2007 and became obsessed. And ever since then, I kind of got into more and more the 2000 post-hardcore bands like Funeral for a Friend, and then through then eventually went to Thursday, and then the wave scene like Touche Amore and La Dispute. And then something that was going on in the UK at the time, like Good Time Boys, Departures, Veils, all those kind of bands. And in the past few years, I got really in touch with the DIY scene, so like putting on shows myself, and that kind of gave me the inspiration to start Death of Youth as a full-time band rather than just me writing songs by myself. As for my mental health, I was diagnosed with autism around the age of 5 years old. And it's kind of one of those things where it's like the world is built for neurotypical people rather than neurodiverse people. So I have had to face a lot of scrutiny, especially when I was in school, from people who just didn't understand that. And because of that, I had a few years of really just trying to pretend that I wasn't autistic, just because I thought I was scared of how other people would perceive me. And it took me a good few years to realize actually the way I am is fine, and I shouldn't need to hide who I am to impress people who I shouldn't need to impress to begin with.
So when you first found the punk scene and started putting on shows and being around other punks, was there a change in as far as how you felt? Maybe not bringing down the mask necessarily, but did you start to feel a bit more comfortable with yourself?
To some degree, yes, because in my first ever band, there were some songs kind of tackling my mental health at the time, but it wasn't really addressing the fact that I was autistic. It was just like very vague kind of mental health stuff. This song that I wrote, which is very much, I didn't go into specifics, it was very much just like, oh, let's write all these metaphors about drowning and stuff because that's how I'm feeling. And then 2016 was when I kind of did a big Twitter post kind of saying, just sharing to all the people I had on there saying, well, right, I'm autistic. I used to be quite open about it. And then I got bullied in school and it made me want to hide it. But now I've realized I don't need to hide it. Those people were irrelevant. And in the more recent years, it's become definitely something I've been a lot more open about, especially coming across other people in the scene. So it's like good to know that the way I discovered punk is somewhat universal. A lot of us, we don't fit in. And that gives us a place to express ourselves, and taking off that mask and revealing our neurodivergent selves. I also think the same for people who are part of the LGBTQ plus community.
So have you known about being on the spectrum for a long, long time? 5 years old, that's a long time to know. And you mentioned kind of having those waves of feeling comfortable to maybe express those traits, but also then being bullied and having to really pull back and hide, and then getting into the punk scene, maybe being able to express yourself in a truer way. So that's a long roller coaster ride of dealing with being on the spectrum. What's that been like?
It's been very challenging because I think at the time when I started school, obviously I got picked up in nursery school, which is kind of like a stepping stone between preschool and kindergarten. Like my teacher kind of picked up, and then I went through all the period of like testing, being diagnosed. I didn't understand it. I was seeing all these different people and didn't understand the relevance of it. And then I started school and having a lot of issues with like my attitude towards learning, because I just didn't get it. I didn't understand why I couldn't just play all the time, basically. And it wasn't until I was like 7 years old, my mum kind of sat me down and said, look, this is why you are the way you are. And as soon as I kind of got it, I was like, okay, this is just who I am, and that's fine. And then when I got to high school, and there was a lot of, I guess, ableism around that. Like, I had a lot of people calling me the arsler, and I think that was a big part of why I began to hide it, especially near the end of high school. I was like, well, I don't want people thinking I'm that. So when I left school and started making friends outside of school, it was very much a need to know basis. Like, the only people I'm telling are the people who actually need to know this. And it was kind of also feeling like people wouldn't like me if they knew I was autistic, which is absurd to me to think about now, 15 years later.
What does it look like for you? Everybody has a different experience and different symptoms and different ways of being. What does it look like for you? You know, they call it a spectrum for obvious reasons. I mean, there's so many different points that people can land on in that spectrum. But what about for you?
I'd say from the smaller scale stuff, like sensories, like there's certain foods I will avoid because I just don't like the texture. And Usually if I don't like a food, it's because of the texture rather than the tastes, that kind of thing. That's relatively minor. Also minor sensory things of like, if I'll be out in a restaurant or something, I'll need to take time to step outside, take a breather, because I'll get a bit overwhelmed. And then also kind of, yes, socially as well. Sometimes it can be a struggle to connect with other people, especially like on things like dating apps. Like some, it can be very draining having all these kind of very, I guess, forced conversations that don't always go somewhere. And there's a lot of neurotypical people on these apps, and conversation doesn't flow as well as it would. But sometimes I've come across like other neurodivergent people, and things feel a lot more easygoing in that way. It's like we just seem to get each other in a way that neurotypical people don't always see eye to eye on.
I have loved ones who are on the spectrum, and one of the things that I appreciate being a punk is the bluntness, just saying exactly what they're feeling, not a lot of filter sometimes, and it's just straight from the heart. I really appreciate that. I think that a lot of people get offended or freaked out by that, but I think it's a really great trait to have, being blunt and saying what they feel to a certain, obviously with some limits.
Yeah, exactly. So obviously it's knowing what to say when, and it's one of those things of members of my family do point out, is that I am an absolutely terrible liar. Like I cannot, even if I try it and say something that isn't true, they will know instantly because I'm not good at it. Not that it happens too often these days, but yeah, it's something I've just never been able to do.
That's funny. So you mentioned having to step out of situations that are noisy or maybe distracting. So we all know that punk shows are this swirling chaos of energy and fun and anger sometimes. So how does that work for you being, you know, in a band or even being at shows? That's a lot of swarming noises and energies.
Weirdly enough, punk shows are like the one place where I don't feel the need to take a step back. Every year I go to Arctangent Festival in Bristol, and sometimes when I'm there, I will take a break from some of the bands to go back to my tent and take some time to unwind, because it's different from like an evening show where you can just there for like maybe 4 hours and you watch like a couple half hour sets and there's breaks in between. And then you can use those breaks between bands to compose yourself and maybe catch up with friends who are at the shows. And whereas a festival is like whole days of bands, so you need to find some time to take a step back and reflect and also decompress. And then for playing shows, it's not something that I've really had an issue with. It's just, especially more recently where Death of Youth, the first band where I've been the front man and being like on stage every night, just talking to the crowd. That's usually something I've been completely fine with. Like, I was really worried about, am I going to know what to do with my hands? Am I just going to stand around? Will I have good stage presence? First practice we had, everything just came really naturally to me, which I was pleasantly surprised by. And it's one of those things I just really get into, which jump around, shout into a microphone, and then talk between songs about stuff that I feel is important to be talked about, because obviously I'm on stage for a finite amount of time. I want to use my microphone to talk about what I feel needs to be shared.
I live with ADHD as well as bipolar, and I find that those shows or even just listening to chaotic loud noise in my headphones does really calm my mind. It does make me feel like I am focused and that I can get into something instead of being all over the place. And that is really cool, because I think people misconceive that punk rock or metal is just a bunch of noise and it's going to freak people out. And really what it does for a lot of people, it sounds like for you and for me, is there's a calm that it creates. Whereas for me, if I listen to something like classical music, I'd be like just completely scratching at my skin.
Yeah, if it was like something like a pop concert or something, I think I wouldn't find it as easy. I'd probably find, like, I once went to a club for a friend's birthday, and clubbing is not my scene at all. And they were playing like a lot of chart music. And even though I had I wear like small little loop ear defenders, my hearing, things like that, even that was really overwhelming for me. And I think it was my first experience clubbing, and I was instantly just like, this reaffirms why I knew this wouldn't be for me.
What parts of being on the spectrum and living with autism works well with writing and playing music?
I guess I've just hyperfixation mainly, because that's one thing I found with autism is when I am interested in something, I get like super into it and I just get obsessed. And sometimes my bank account takes a hit from that because I end up buying a lot of stuff related to that special interest. And I think when I'm like into like music, I have to get really into a band or something. And guess when I'm writing, I'm like able to just focus on it because I'm hyperfixating upon it. I wrote the lyrics for our most recent album all over the summer. And I was really surprised at myself for doing that, because usually when I started writing lyrics, it took me a while to get things done. But I had all the songs for the album. I just thought once a day I'd be like, okay, I'm going to sit down, I'm going to write the lyrics for this song, this is what it's going to be about. And it all came together like really naturally in the way that I had before, where it would take me months to write lyrics. It took me maybe 9 days or so to write lyrics, because there's like 9 songs on the album. It's like writing one set of lyrics a day and then refining them later on when there's like certain lines. Yeah, that line could be better. And then taking that line out, switching it with another one. So yeah, so it's mainly the hyperfixation of wanting to do it that helps with when I'm writing.
What about being on stage? Is there things that you bring on stage that you feel like are positive traits or strengths?
I guess it's just that honesty with myself, because like I said, I'm now at a place where I am relaxed and happy with who I am, and I'm just able to be myself on stage. Like, I remember there was one show we played over the summer where we hadn't had a practice before that show, so I hadn't really prepared a lot of what I was going to say, aside from like what we'd said at the previous show. And then I just found myself just saying anything that came into my head on stage. It just felt really natural. And I just felt like, this is like the most myself I've felt on stage. This feels great. And that was something I felt worked really well.
You mentioned earlier about finding acceptance when you were out of school and being more comfortable with yourself. What did that look like for you?
Well, I think a big part of it was, I did realize for a good 5 years after I left school that I had some kind of PTSD, which sounds weird to say, from that experience, because I was having a lot of occasional nightmares about some of my school time tormentors and just absolutely dreading running into them. And then I think I woke up one day from one of these nightmares when I was about 22 and realized, okay, I'm kind of messed up. I need to address this. I didn't go to therapy, but I kind of took my own time to process everything and worked out where it was all coming from. And then I kind of started to just realize how pathetic the people I was dealing with were in hindsight. It was just the fact of they took issue with me because I wasn't like them. And why did it bother them so much? And I just kind of started laughing about it. And that kind of started me on the journey of actually, I'm fine being autistic. And it's kind of like looking into it a bit more. And I found out Dan Aykroyd from Ghostbusters, which was one of my favorite films at the time,
yeah,
that he was also on the spectrum. And that, so finding out that was a big help as well. That kind of made me think, okay, oh, there's some cool people who have autism as well. And I think another one was apparently Einstein was supposedly on the spectrum, but I don't know if that was confirmed or not. Yeah, knowing that there were people out there on the spectrum was affirming to me.
Kids that are on the spectrum often get labeled as special students, ones that are, you know, they say geniuses or whatever. And really, it's not. It's just a different way of learning that maybe the school system isn't used to.
Yeah, exactly. It's like my brain works differently. So the way I look at neurodivergence is it's kind of like a different operating system of like, say, a neurotypical person's brain is like a PC, a neurodivergent person's brain is like a Mac.
There's a lot of Macs out there. More and more. Mm-hmm. When Mac first came out, no one even knew what it was. And then, you know, I guess what I'm trying to get at is I think that way more people are on the spectrum than maybe that we know. And I think that it's very, I don't want to normalize it, but it's very common. And I think that the more that we realize that the better the whole society will be, because now we're embracing different kinds of learning, different kinds of even personalities. And it's the same with all mental health conditions. When I was diagnosed with bipolar, same deal. I didn't realize that a lot of my favorite musicians were living with that. And it's out there. And I think that sometimes getting a diagnosis or learning about it is huge.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. It's like hearing about different people's experiences does open your eyes. Because I do remember when after I left school, a lot of mental health kind of stuff was scrutinized as being like attention seeking. It kind of made people reluctant to seek out their help. But I think things have come a long way since then, but still not 100%, but we're on the right track.
So positive aspects of playing music and writing music, there has to be challenges as well.
Yes, there are. I think the biggest thing is for me is sometimes writer's block. I can get some quite hefty writer's block sometimes. Like I won't know how to finish a song. I won't know how to have like a guitar part, and then I'll be like, where do I go from here? And it would take me a while to figure that out. And that can get quite frustrating. And also second guessing myself. Because when I started Deaf Youth, it was like the first time I'd done something all by myself. Because when in my first band, when I was in those late teens to early 20s, I found a lot of my lyrics, they had good parts, but I'd find a lot of them would get tweaked a little bit. And I was really worried that when I was first doing something by myself, that, oh my God, what if people think these lyrics are terrible? But then I think when And Stuff finally got released, there were people who were actually praising the lyrics. And I was like, well, okay, so maybe I can do this. I don't need to have them tweaked all the time.
So Dan Aykroyd being on the spectrum, I'm sure other celebrities and people have come out about it. So was there anybody in the music scene that you saw and maybe gave you some comfort, or knowing that there was people that were doing similar things that you were or that you wanted to?
I'd say most recently, it was probably, again, like I mentioned earlier, finding out that Alex CF was on the spectrum and that he had a similar experience to me in his journey of finding punk. That was something that's really referring to me in later life. But I couldn't find anything about any like neurodivergent punks before then. But obviously we clearly exist because I've met a fair few since doing more DIY kind of shows. And it's like crazy how this all like brings us together. I do want to be more open about, I know 16-year-old me was feeling like I couldn't be autistic, I shouldn't be autistic, that the way I was quote unquote wrong. But I feel if like someone was in a band and talking about that on stage, I would have come to that place of acceptance a lot more, being like, oh, okay, that person in the band I really like is also autistic. Basically, if anyone listening to this is autistic and wants to start a band or wants to make music, just go and do it, please, because I want more of us in the scene. There is definitely plenty of us, but we need to be very open about it. We need to make people know that it's okay. We're all welcome here.
So how does it feel knowing that you might be that person for somebody else?
I think that would be very rewarding to know that someone has been inspired by something that I have said or done. Is like the most flattering thing that I can think of. Think that I have inspired someone in the way that someone else has inspired me. I just find it really rewarding, very gratifying, like knowing that I have inspired someone to do something positive.
What's one of the misconceptions that people have about someone who's on the spectrum? What things have you come up against?
I guess it's that whole idea of people have like a very perceived idea of what autism is. When I went on a date just to start my first adult relationship, I had on my dating profile that I was autistic. And I remember her saying something like, oh yeah, I wouldn't have thought you're autistic if you hadn't had that on there. And it's one of those, almost a backhanded compliment of being like, oh, you expect it to be like Rain Man or something, or that whole like, oh yeah, you don't look like you're autistic kind of thing. And it's like, that's not how it works. Like, it doesn't affect physical appearance. I don't know why people expect autistic people to all look a certain way.
When someone asks you a question like, what is it like to be on the spectrum? What is it like to have autism? What's the easiest answer you can give them with that, you know, you're comfortable with?
Okay, so my analogy for autism would be that it's kind of like playing a video game on hard mode while watching the rest of the world play the same game on easy mode.
That was my conversation with Rob David of Death of Youth, deathofyouthukhc.bandcamp.com. For more episodes of Screen Therapy, go to screentherapyhq.com or wherever you listen to podcasts. The Screen Therapy book is available now. Screen Therapy, A Punk Journey Through Mental Health, tells my story and the stories of others who use punk as a catalyst for mental health. Like this podcast, it links the community-minded punk scene with the mental wellness of the punks who belong to it. To order the book, go to screentherapyhq.com. For merch, check out screentherapy.threadless.com. Okay, enough promoting. It's time for some thanking. Thank you for listening to Screen Therapy. Doing this podcast and talking to folks about punk rock and mental health has been a crucial part of my own mental stability, and it means so much to me that you're out there listening. Screen Therapy is created in the Cathet region of coastal British Columbia, Canada, on the traditional territory of the Klahaman Nation. Contact me at screentherapyhq.com or email me at screentherapypodcast@gmail.com. I'd love to hear from you. Let's talk about punk rock and mental health. Until next time, take care and be well.
You are listening to CJSF 90.1 FM. Broadcasting from Burnaby Mountain, British Columbia.
Staff and volunteers at CJSF wish you a jolly, merry, happy, joyful, fantastic, exciting, fancy, magnificent, remarkable, special, white, sparkling, terrific, stunning, festive, and wonderful holiday season.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections.
Hundreds of sensors mounted to road signs and telephone poles across New York City are gathering data, not about people or traffic, but about flooding.
With climate change, there's a projected increase in the amount of flooding, both due to high-intensity precipitation events and also due to sea level rise.
Andrea Silverman of New York University's Tandon School of Engineering helps lead the FloodNet project. Her team works with local residents and city agencies to identify streets and intersections that are prone to flooding during storms or high tides. In those spots, they've installed about 300 solar-powered sensors that use ultrasound to detect and measure floodwater. The data is transmitted in real time to a public online dashboard so people can see which areas are flooded and which roads are still safe to travel.
So if there's a road that they typically use, they may need to know, is that road currently accessible? Can I pass through it or should I wait until floodwaters go down?
Emergency services can also use the data to respond faster when flooding happens. And over time, this highly specific information reveals exactly where flooding is worst, helping the city target flood prevention projects where they're needed most.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
You're listening.